This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
The 37 verses on the practices of a bodhisattva, verse 5. Giving up negative friendships. When friendship with someone causes the three poisons to increase, degrades the activities of listening, reflecting, and meditating, and destroys loving kindness and compassion, to give up such a friendship is the practice of a bodhisattva. So in these early verses, it may seem strange within the bodhisattva path that there's so much emphasis on the negative aspects of our relationships with people, family, loved ones, friends, possessions, given saving all sentient beings and all that. An alternate translation is, in bad company, the three poisons grow stronger. Now, of course, these teachings are not suggesting that there is anyone or anything that possesses inherent evil, negativity, badness. Inherent meaning that it is permanent, it is the essential nature of that person or thing, it is unchangeable. It is their identity. That identity exists from that view. It is who they are. If that were so, then there's nothing that person or anyone else could do about it. That person would be stuck in their negativity without any possibility of change, and everyone else around them would have little recourse except to stay away. Really, what these teachings are pointing to is the lack of stability that we as practitioners have in the early years. And it's really important to appreciate when we talk about the early stages of practicing, we're talking about years in which we're susceptible, we're highly susceptible to the influence of our own mind, our mental states, our karmic impulses, our attachments, emotions, clinging. But also, we're very susceptible to those same things within other people. And so we're, in a sense, in a fragile state. That's what we start to recognize when we start practicing. Already to some degree, we probably recognize that we can't, even though we may be very willful, and most people are very willful, that we can't willfully change something that's a deep habit, a deep pattern. And in that willfulness, which can seem very solid and fixed and strong, we're very fragile, because we're very susceptible to that very thing. One teacher commenting on this said, if you're a special being who possesses skillful means, you can carry all mental poisons and afflictions onto the path. In other words, whatever you encounter within yourself or another, you just bring it into your path. You put it directly in service to your own liberation. He says, that is, you can use them as a basis for practice. But if you're an ordinary person, then associating with negative friends will cause your own afflictions to increase. Then he goes on to say, to clarify this meaning of ordinary being and special person, he said, think of an analogy. Consider the vast amount of waste eliminated by the inhabitants of a large city. Ordinary beings are disgusted by the sewage. They want to be rid of it. It's dirty. It stinks. It breeds disease. But a farmer is a special being in this realm, who's grateful to obtain this negative substance, which everyone else rejects. Their skill allows them to use this waste to fertilize their fields and make their harvest more abundant. It's a nice analogy. He said it's the same with the five afflictions. While ordinary beings must rid themselves of their afflictions, the skillful individual can carry them onto the path and transform them into the five wisdoms. And so this is, in a sense, in brief, he's really laying out the trajectory of the path. But so as students, and as in any endeavor, we have to start with the fundamentals. We have to build the fundamentals. And that's true in anything. You know, when we first start speaking, when we're little children, we don't just immediately start, you know, espousing great literature, right? We goo goo gaga, right? We start making sounds, and then we start building on those sounds, and we start learning how to read. We start with letters, and then we form words, and then we form sentences. It's the same in any endeavor. It makes sense, right? It makes sense. So why should this be any different? Well, in a certain sense, you could say because when we're learning how to speak, for instance, while we have the capacity to speak, we don't fully possess that capacity in full at that moment. And so we have to develop it. And so in practice, although we possess Buddha nature in full, in other words, there's nothing lacking in our essential nature of mind, which is enlightened, which is awakened, which is clear and boundless, nor do we lack any of the essentials of compassion and all of the qualities of that. And we could say that they're not yet fully developed, or we could say that we have developed other things to such a good degree and in such a way that they have so much influence that they overshadow, they eclipse that fully present enlightened mind and wisdom and compassion. And so when we begin practicing, and what these verses are really pointing to is it's like if you think of the Buddha in his very first teaching, just having experienced this great awakening and having spent time right there at what came to be called Bodhgaya, I think of it as sort of, not so much basking, but sort of saturating in his enlightenment, taking it in. And this is just me talking. This is not what happened. But sort of just taking in the magnitude, not just of the experience itself and what that revealed to him, but of all the implications of that, of all that it revealed to him. In fact, there's a very small temple, several hundred yards away from the Bodhi tree, the side of the Bodhi tree, where it said he stood for 7 days, something like that, just looking, gazing back at the site where he sat and came to enlightenment. So just imagine that. But then he went to teach, right? And so he found that original group of ascetics that he practiced with for so long. And he sat down and he started to expound the Four Noble Truths. So where did he begin? Life is dukkha. Now he had just experienced complete liberation from dukkha. Why didn't he start there? Because no one else was there. The people he was talking to were not there. They were in that First Noble Truth. And so that's where we practice. We practice in the beginning at that very place, which is to say, we practice where we're at. And so we experience things as things. We experience them as coming towards us, happening to us, other people, situations, events, emotions. They just appear. I didn't invite you here. Why'd you show up? I didn't ask to be thinking about this or to remember this. Why did you show up? Right? So there's the very real sense that something is just happening. Right? It's clearly my mind, but it's in a way, another way, not of my own doing somehow. And so there's that sense that this has some kind of power. In Buddhism, we call it its own power, its own being, to do exactly that, to appear uninvited and to impact. That's where we start. That's our actual experience. That's the thing we, in essence, trust. We trust that experience. That's real for us. And so to abandon our native land because we have grasping towards friends and hatred towards enemies, to give up negative places because places can be so distracting and draw us in, to let go of this life, friends, relatives, possessions, the body, the self, the person, life itself, and now to give up negative friendships. So it seems like what we're being directed to do is to sort of turn away from all of these relationships, all of these things in our life, right, that constitute sort of the stuff of our life, to turn away from all of those things, to reject the friends, the family, the possessions, the place, the home, and to isolate ourselves so we can become enlightened. And that would be a grave misunderstanding. But we might understand how you could come to that misunderstanding if you just read the language, just read the words, right? Which is why the teachings, these kinds of teachings so often are presented just like this, where they're very dense, they're very concentrated. They're not difficult to understand, you know, necessarily, these particular teachings, which is what makes them so precarious. Because they seem to be so easy to understand, they're in fact very easy to misunderstand. I might even venture to say that that's a general rule of thumb. That if you ever encounter a Dharma and you think, I got that, slow down, beware. Very likely there's something there, right, that we're getting drawn into and fooled by. So, isolating oneself, rejecting others, is not our path. This is not the Bodhisattva path. But remember, there are 37 verses, right? We're at the beginning. And what it's laying out is where do we begin? And also to appreciate that the whole project is intended for you to succeed. The whole thing is presented for you to accomplish. And so it's presented accordingly for that reason. Its purpose is to guide us into that all-encompassing great heart of compassion, that great love which is equal, non-discriminating, fearless, patient, grounded in prajna wisdom. And so we walk the path step by step. Another way of thinking of these verses is what they're saying is, because they're really directing us, they're teaching, they're saying, okay, here, watch out for those friendships, observe those friendships, watch out for those places. Be careful of those that you've so dearly love, be careful of those that you hate. Which is really saying, in general, just observe. Be observant of the people, the places, the things, and specifically, how we get drawn in. How in their presence, as well as in our own presence of mind, of emotions, of states, how we get drawn in. And again, even the language echoes our experience. I'm getting drawn in. Something is pulling me in. I don't want to go, but it's pulling me. As opposed to how do I jump into, how do I leap into this? How do I return to this again and again? How do I even seek this out? And how do these people and places and things, in a sense, encourage that or bring that about? And in observing, that's sort of predicated on the understanding that that doesn't have to happen. That way of responding that we see in ourselves, and we should also be observing it in others, because we learn a tremendous amount by just being observant of others, being a student of things, of the world, of people. It presumes that we believe that while it may seem inexorable, it may seem, you know, that I have very little power over the way I react, that in some way I do, I must. This isn't set. And so because that can be so difficult, I mean, just think of Zazen. You're sitting there on the cushion, nothing's happening, right? Nobody's talking to you. Nobody's asking you to do anything. Nobody's interacting with you. That's why it's so important. That's why it's so powerful, because it lays bare that before anything moves, we're already caught. And that's being caught by the one that we have the most measure of control over or influence over. And so these teachings are saying, create helpful circumstances. And in doing that, in letting go of these things, as these verses seem to suggest, all of those experiences are going to keep happening. Right? It's not that we can't actually create such a state where the mind is pure and tranquil and there's no negativity. That's not even the point. The point is that they will arise because they're arising. They're already active. But in a simpler, less sort of difficult circumstances, their arising will be simpler. They won't be so strong, so complex, so difficult. And so we'll be able to begin to develop our practice with those strong negative states that arise, negative from that point of view that we're beginning in, which there is the inherently negative and there is the inherently positive. So we can begin to practice them and begin to develop our skills, you might say, develop our confidence and our capacity to actually meet ourselves. And as the Buddha said, to do that sounds so simple. Just don't deny or reject anything. Oh, and don't pursue it either. Got it? And to see how many ways, how much of the time we are dwelling in exactly those two realms. And so that's what we're practicing, is how to meet what arises without aversion, without attachment, which is a attraction kind of attachment. And then how to meet and develop stability with all of the other sort of collateral things that arise. Fear, insecurity, judgment, irritation. So we practice our mindfulness. The capacity to actually hold what is in front of us in our mind without wavering, and to recognize it, to know that we are experiencing this, to know what we're experiencing, to know its quality. Is this helpful to you? Is it not helpful to you? To see it come and go, to see it arise within this body and mind. You didn't do this to me. You didn't cause this to arise. We can have faith that the source of all of these states is not within another person. It's not in the object. It's not in the situation. We may believe that, feel very confident of that. we may have even had direct insight into it. We can understand that good and bad doesn't exist in some kind of autonomous, intrinsic way within things. That people who do bad things, terribly bad things, are not inherently bad. That people who live well, who live good lives, are not inherently good. We can see all of that and that historical, karmic, impulsive consciousness can still react, will still react. And so as we gain confidence and concentration and resilience and patience and so forth, we then, through the course of training, in a sense, venture forth deeper and deeper into samsara. One of the ways that happens in training in a monastery is responsibility. With a small sangha like this, that we have a relatively small sangha, monastic and resident sangha, part of the nature of it is that people often get drawn in, you know, given positions that are considerable in their responsibility quite early in their training. Right? Whereas in a much larger monastery, that might, you know, wait until a person has had time to really sort of get their legs on the ground. And so there's a lot of challenge in that, but also there's a lot of really good practice in that, right? Because it's all there right from the beginning. It also means that in order for this all to work out, we have to have those experiences over and over and over again. Right? I mean, how often have we really learned something we needed to learn on the first pass? You know, in a way that goes deep. We have to actually, because it's not knowledge. There may be knowledge. There may be understanding, but that itself very often is not enough. We have to actually live it, experience it, and both experience whatever might be obstructing us, experience our going the old way, but now we're paying attention. We're beginning to see more into it, and then experience, live a new way, a new path. I was thinking about when I was young and this verse about being influenced by others, that when I was young, grade school and then into high school for a while, you know, me and my gang of friends used to get into trouble. That was sort of how we thought we were having fun. And so we would get into, you know, mischief. We called it something else, but let's call it mischief. And and we would, you know, do stuff that caused trouble. And I was thinking about, I never did that by myself. I never went out by myself and thought, I'm going to go cause some trouble. Right? It was always with others. And it was always with my friends, right, with whom, and they were all doing the same thing, I'm pretty sure, that we were all sort of getting into trouble. No one of us actually wanting to be the initiator. No one of us wanting to do it, oftentimes, but not having the courage to not do it. And as I grew older, on into high school, that just became more and more unsatisfying. It became more and more uncomfortable, and I think I had some sense at the time, more later, that I found myself more and more frequently in situations of inner conflict. There's something going on. We're all going in this direction. I don't really want to go that way. Right? This no longer really is working for me. And I too didn't have the courage to say, wait a minute, stop. Is this like, does this make sense? Like, does anybody actually want to be doing this? Is there anything else we could be doing? But I was immature, right? I was young. I had very little skills, not a lot of understanding of what was even going on. And so the only way I really learned, was able to sort of deal with it, was just to begin to withdraw, right? So first I withdrew by just sometimes when we were doing stuff, talking about what we were going to do, I just would be silent, right? I would sort of be there in abstention, right? But I remember one time something happened and my father found out about it. And he said, were you part of this? And I said, well, I knew what was going on, but I didn't actually contribute. And he said, that doesn't matter. I said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? He said, you were still part of it. You knew it was happening. And you didn't do anything to stop it. And I felt so justified in my indignation because I wanted to present as though I had done the right thing, but inwardly I knew he was right. And so to think about all those moments in our lives, still, where we enter into someone else's field, a fear of judgment, of laziness, of hatred, of doubt, of cynicism, their field of energy, their field of their mind, and how that stirs us, right? How we are influenced by that. And it's not that we're trying to cut ourselves off, right? But how do we, in a sense, transform that influence? That's really what we're looking at. And how do we understand it? And how do we deal with that desire that we have to be connected, to be in this relationship? Right? Particularly if it's somebody we care about or have cared about or have had a connection relationship with, you know, wanting to be in communion, in community, and how that desire can overtake our good sense or what we know to be true. And so as he says, that degrades the activities of listening, reflecting, meditating, and begins to corrode our loving kindness and compassion. And what he's pointing to here is how, again, vulnerable we are, that our capacity to just hear, our capacity to reflect, our capacity to meditate in the beginning is not stable, right? I mean, just think about how in Zazen, how easily the mind gets thrown off and distracted by just the sound of the garbage truck, right? Or the sound of something happening next to you, or just the grain of the wood in your field of vision, or a sensation, and suddenly the mind takes off. We're vulnerable. And so our senses, our attention, our concerns can be very easily moved into another direction. Meanwhile, the Dharma, that which we're studying, is very subtle. It's very profound. It doesn't, you know, it's not like modern culture, right? Which is, if it's not screaming, it must not be worthwhile, right? There's so much about this Dharma that can so easily be missed. It requires careful, meticulous attention. And over time, not just instants, not just moments, but actually being able to hold that over time. Which is one reason Sesshin is so important, actually sitting for extended periods of time. Because certain things happen. Things happen differently when we're sitting over extended periods of time than when we're sitting just in smaller periods. So to give up such a friendship is the practice of a bodhisattva when we encounter those, when we enter into those fields with others and we realize how the effect that they have on us. And another way of saying, of what this is saying, is know your own mind and know your own direction. Because nobody else can do that. Nobody else can know that. You know, what intention and aspiration is about is reflecting on and coming to your own determination of what you want to do in this life. Because nobody else, well, other people will do that for you. They will tell you what you should do, who you should be, where you should go. And that can be helpful. But ultimately, we each have to make our own determination. And so to know your own mind and your own direction. And so this doesn't mean to just jettison everyone you find difficult, because you're not going to be able to do that anyway. Right? There's an old sort of truism in monastic life that there will always be at least one person who's been invited here specifically to make you crazy. We have invited them here just for you. You're welcome. And when they leave, guess what? Somebody else appears. And so we're not going to get away from it. But again, even within the Sangha, so that's still happening, but it's happening within a very particular field. We call it a Buddha field. And so it doesn't mean to try and get rid of what is difficult, but rather to be awake within our life and all of those intersections where our path intersects with others. And when we experience that conflict or that tension or that influence, what can you do to clear your path? Because that person is giving you the opportunity right then, because you can't do it abstractly. You can't sit down and dream about it and come up with a perfect situation and solution and enlightenment and life forever. I mean, you can do all of that, but you know what that is. And so studying how, like when somebody really gets under your skin, why? Why that person? Why under your skin in that particular way? That's a result of causes and conditions. There is a coming together in that that is very particular to you. It's particular to each of us because it's our reaction. It's our irritation. And so what do we see? What is it that makes us so vulnerable to another's emotions? What are those emotions that we find so difficult? Those gestures, those manners of speaking, those words. And what's in that relationship? How do we see that person? What have we done with them in our mind? How do we want to be seen by them? Do we see the moment where within that influence we begin to turn away from ourselves? Right? It's like you're standing true, you're feeling, your senses, you're authentic, and the reason you know that is because in the next moment you realize something's shifting. You're not on the same ground anymore. What's happening? In that moment, what are we placing above our own authenticity, our own well-being, our own path? And what that means to know your own mind and know your own direction is that sometimes you may find yourself standing alone. And I suspect, I don't know, but I imagine that many practitioners understand that experience of having been in the midst, in the company of, and yet feeling somehow alone. Which is why the other side of the bad company is good company. The Dalai Lama said it's very important to accompany with, to acquaint yourself with good friends, healthy friends, friends who encourage your good side. That is, all the parts of you, all the ways in which you want all that is good. And to do all that is good. He says there are so many cases of people who, due to the influence of their friends, begin drugging and drinking and getting into trouble. I would think that's the norm. And so noble friends, good friendships, are a treasure. They bring out the best in us. They provide us with good examples. They support us and inspire us. They help to, you know, that feeling of aloneness can be a feeling of strangeness, particularly before, I think, we encounter the Sangha, right? When you may literally be alone in your interest, not even finding the Dharma yet, but just interest in your life or the world or things that it seems to be different than those around you. That was why I withdrew in school, is because I wasn't finding, other than within a small group of friends, I wasn't finding that kind of affinity. And as that affinity within myself became more and more important, harder and harder to turn away from, to deny, to just go on as though, those few friends that I felt a reasonable amount of affinity became even more important. And so just think about sitting here in the Zendo or sitting there at home, and you're tired, maybe sleepy, or you're feeling dull, maybe lazy, you're doubting yourself, and you look up or you look to the side and you see someone who appears to be just really throwing themselves into it. Or you see them struggling too, but you can see their effort. They're not holding back. And what does that do to you? How does that help us? And that what makes that so powerful is that that example, they're not performing for us, right? They're not being self-conscious. They're just in their seat. They're standing on their ground. They're doing that thing that we yearn to do, that we may have wandered away from doing. And in that moment, they're providing that benefit to us. They're giving us that. And so having received that, then why don't you become the one to offer that? Of course. And again, the way to do that is to not be self-conscious or have imposed some idea of being a good example. That's never a very good example, but just actually know your mind, know where you need to be, put yourself there, practice that like your life depends upon it. Stay close to that. Let that speak. Know that that is speaking. You don't need to make anything of it. That pure mind is always speaking, always expressing, always communicating. That's why there is something that happens when we practice that you can't measure, you can't necessarily even point to. Of course, there are moments where you might feel that, be aware of that inspiration, but it's happening all the time by practicing together. It's a form of giving. Master Dogen said, when a person, quoting the Buddha, Master Dogen said, when a person who practices giving goes into an assembly, people take notice. And I read that to mean that it doesn't mean everybody turns and looks and says, oh, this person is giving. It doesn't mean that. It means that as that person enters the room, their field enters the room. Their mind consciousness enters the room, of course. And it mingles with our mind. And we notice. We might notice consciously and may not understand why, or we may notice beneath our consciousness and not even know. Dogen says, the truth, this truth, can turn into valuables, can become very valuable, very powerful. And that which has become powerful turns into truth. And this is all because the one who is giving is willing. Because the one who is practicing is by their very nature giving that. And then he says, the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. You were not the first person to notice that about your own mind. Right? This is an ancient truth. And then he goes on to say, so now keep on changing the mind of yourself and sentient beings by giving, by offering, by knowing your mind, by being very clear about what your practice is, about what you want your life to be right now. And do that all the way through. Just keep doing that until you and everybody else attains the way. To give up such a friendship, which is obstructive to us, is preparing us, is training us in how to open that great heart of love and compassion towards everyone in a real way. Where the people, there are people who are still creating negativity, who are still difficult. And it is no longer the same. It's not the same.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.